You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is it, a huge game-changing episode of Game of Thrones. Jon Snow alive, we can finally talk about that. Ramsay Bolton, unfortunately, also still alive. It's a big week for both the Bastards of Westeros and a big week for EW2. We just announced our Kit Harington exclusive cover interview, which was secretly in the making for a long time, so we'll talk about that. Editor-at-large James Hibbard.
And I'm senior writer Darren Franich. And James, I'm feeling personally betrayed here. I thought we were friends, man. I thought you told me everything. I thought that, you know, you'd always be honest with me. How could you keep this secret from me, from everyone, probably, for so long? I mean, to come from watching this episode reeling from the fact that he was, in fact, coming back to life. Then I go to the EW.com website to see, oh, my podcasting buddy probably knew about this for a long time.
Honestly, one of the toughest things is you kept asking me questions about Jon Snow on the last two podcasts. I kept trying to dance around it, and inside I'm going, quit asking me about that, because there's, you know, there's so much to say and so little that I could say. I mean, you know, in the end of the episode, it's like Jon Snow does this big gasping inhale, and that's kind of how I feel, because I feel like I've been holding my breath for 7 months waiting to talk about this, A, and B, thinking with every Game of Thrones Google alert on my phone that, okay, now it's going to leak. Now it's going to leak. And amazingly, although, you know, a lot of people figured he was probably coming back, nobody knew for sure, and they didn't know how. And you got to experience it totally cold while I, you know, knew about it in advance. So I think that's interesting because we're going to have two different, very different perspectives on a huge episode. So I think we should start by breaking down this episode and talking about the major parts of it. And then in the second half, we'll switch gears. We'll talk about a little bit about our Harrington cover story that goes behind the scenes of how they pulled this off, as well as do our trivia question to give away the Blu-ray and answer some of a listener's questions.
One thing that I want to discuss here, James, is that, you know, the Jon Snow storyline now, we're agreeing to call it that because, you know, Jon Snow, you know, he's a handsome boy, he's, you know, glamorous, he's a hero. But of course, you know, us hardcore fans know this is really just a continuation of the Davos-Seaworth storyline. And at the beginning of this episode, we sort of saw what I think was kind of the last climactic moment in the teasers for this season, the sort of Davos versus Night's Watch traitors face-off. Gave him a great hero moment. But this also led to the reintroduction of a character who, frankly, I'm always shocked that, like, he isn't just always around, because he always seems to solve things. We had some great one-one time in this episode, didn't we, James?
Yeah, he totally did the, like, Loki Hulk smash move with the archer that dared put an arrow into him.
There were two different head smashes in the first 10 minutes of this episode, and that one was definitely...
Yeah, I know, it's just like... It was a very bad day for being smashed into walls.
What was Alistair Thorne's, like, plan in all of this? Like, do you think, like, they were going to, like, burn Jon Snow and then just kind of keep on being the Night's Watch? Or were they going to burn Jon Snow and then kind of declare themselves, like, you know, petty little dictators of the northernmost corner of the North? I kept on kind of, like, going back and forth on to what extent he was doing this to sort of maintain the watch and to what extent he was just kind of like, we're on a kamikaze run now. We're just going to have as much fun as we can before the apocalypse happens.
You know, that's a good question, but he's always been such a Night's Watch loyalist to some degree, and that's just been, you know, the governing force in his life that, I mean, I always sort of defend Thorne a little bit in these conversations.
A bold defense of Alistair Thorne, one of the most loathed characters on the show. I can go along with that.
He's a pragmatist, and he's like one of those Shades of Grey characters that if Jon Snow wasn't around, that we might be in a situation situation where we're kind of rooting for, like we root for, like, you know, Jamie Lannister or other people.
What was interesting here, James, is that coming after the end of episode revelation last week about Melisandre and the nature of her magic, was we got in this storyline, we had a really interesting moment. I thought, you know, we've talked about how as we get deeper and deeper into this story, you know, both in A Song of Ice and Fire and now in Game of Thrones, you know, there's more magic and more mysticism. You know, dragons are alive again, and there's a lot of talk about different gods. And I felt as if Davos Seaworth was sort of talking for all of us when he was telling Melisandre, like, listen, like, all I know is that, you know, you definitely have some kind of a power, Melisandre. He was sort of, it was interesting to see him sort of coax her out of what seemed like a real existential crisis. We've seen so much, like, between the two of them. How did that kind of play for you? The former Stannis acolytes sort of joining forces again.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, all this time, you know, Ser Davos and Melisandre have had this contentious relationship, and you get the feeling that the last thing that he wants is for her to be this powerful, scary witch with all this control. And then he's going in there like, why won't you be a powerful, scary witch? Why can't you be what I have not wanted you to be, you know, pretty much throughout the entire show up until this point? It's like, now I actually need you to be that. Now I actually want you to be that. And you're like sitting there all bummed out and, you know, you're staring in the mirror with your necklace off on occasion. So, it was interesting to see him pull her out of her depression, really. And, you know, your point about the gods is interesting because, you know, that wasn't the only reference to that in this episode. There's also the conversation with Jaime and the High Sparrow, which riffed on this similar notion in terms of, you know, do the gods care? To what role do the gods actually play in people's lives?
I'm so glad, James, just to quickly call out one of my favorite parts of your recap, in that Jaime Sparrow conversation, which for me really felt like, you know, every now and then on Game of Thrones, we get a Pacino and De Niro in Heat moment of these two characters who've been separately very powerful for a while finally meet. That had, you know, there was kind of that quality to their meeting. And, you know, the High Sparrow was talking all about how, oh, like, you know, us faceless poor people, you know, we don't have any families, but we can topple an empire. I think it was in your recap you referred to him as Bernie Sparrow, which I was quite tickled by. There is the notion of, you know, the High Sparrow is now leading his own kind of class revolution.
If the Iron Bank is too big to fail, it's too big to exist. Yes, exactly.
Okay, but wait, James, before we leave the North, one other thing that I really liked about the Melisandre and Davos conversation was I like how Davos basically told her exactly what we were all thinking. He basically said, your magic, I don't really know what the deal is with your magic, but I assume you can bring someone back to life. So can you just try to do something like along those lines?
Right.
And mystically, it did seem to work. We'll talk about this more later, but your kind of just like initial reactions, the idea that Jon Snow is back to life. We have seen someone brought back to life using the power of the Red God. And we know that, like, when that happens, it's not necessarily the greatest thing ever. Like, people are never really quite the same. It's interesting that, you know, we literally just cut right as he comes back to life with no further indication of what his state of mind is, shall we say.
I think it's a safe bet that he's probably not going to be exactly the same and is going to be impacted by this. And actually, that's one of the things we get into in our, you know, not to pimp it, but our cover story. We spent some time on the set of season 6 talking to Harrington on set. And, you know, it's definitely an interesting thing they have planned, because as he pointed out, if he came back and everything went back exactly the way it was before, then what would be the point in his character dying? And so that was very much something that was you know, on the minds of Kit Harington and on the minds of the writers. You know, another thread too out of this, and not to jump over to it entirely, but Balon Greyjoy, obviously, you know, he is one of the three kings that Melisandre cursed back in season 3 with throwing those leeches into the fire. And then, you know, the first two died, Joffrey and Robb, but Balon didn't die. And so there's a sort of thought of, well, was that just showmanship, or was she working some sort of magic there? And so to have that happen in this episode too was interesting, because book readers have been waiting for this to happen for a long time, for Balon Greyjoy to kick off. You know, so it brings to mind once again this idea of, are the gods actually involved, or is it just things that humans are doing and they're just attributing things to the gods? All the kings that died were at the hands and machinations of other characters, but at the same time, those three people she cursed now are all dead. And as soon as that, you know, finally happens, you know, then we have this scene, even though she doesn't know that happened, we have this scene where she kind of rallies and is able to use her power, or the Lord of Light's power, you know, to bring back this character.
Here's my issue. Like, listen, I can understand Melisandre having sort of a minor existential crisis, but like, listen, lady, you have done actual magic. Like, this is, you know, this is not a matter of somebody, you know, you have given birth to a, like, murder monster, and you know, you have, like, there are certain elements of fundamental truth in whatever magic you're doing. Frankly, at this point, Melisandre, you might be the god for all I know. Maybe it's time for you to go and set up your own sort of minor cult of personality.
Here's a question, though. Does doing this make the threat of death diminished on Game of Thrones? Does playing this card for a major character sort of make the stakes seem lower moving forward?
The short answer, James, is yes, it totally does. The longer answer is, you know, the core of the end of this story, and, you know, who knows how close we are to the end, but the idea of people coming back to life, you could argue it is right there in the opening minutes of Game of Thrones. Admittedly, you know, the White Walkers bringing people back to a sort of half-life, that's not quite the same as, you know, Kit Harington suddenly opening his eyes at the end of an episode, but there's always kind of been this idea of, you know, this is a world where resurrection is possible, and perhaps even this is a world where, on a more character level, transformation is possible. You know, one of the things that I think a lot of people who aren't as big a fans of the later books tend to diminish is, in the later books, you really see a lot of characters trying to change themselves. And, you know, Tyrion is, you know, going through a state of transformation, and Jaime Lannister is really kind of transforming. So I think if they can weave in the idea of, yes, Jon Snow is back to life, so to a certain extent, this is the kind of Gandalf coming back to life moment, where, you know, it's kind of like, okay, maybe death isn't as important as we once thought. But if there's a way to kind of really weave in the idea that he's a different person, and, you know, not for nothing too, like, you know, they're doing this towards the end of the show, so it seems to me as if it's understood this is a one-time thing. Or at the very least, in the episode where Jon Snow comes back to life, I'm not immediately thinking, oh man, great, like, next up they're going to bring back Roose Bolton, you know? So, because also, again, I mean, the reason why I don't think anybody really thought Jon Snow was going to stay dead was last year they specifically added in the Hardhome sequence, which ends with Jon Snow facing off against the Night's King in a way that, on a very deep level, you just felt like these characters will meet again. And what better way for, you know, for a sort of scary, freakish creature overlord who may be undead or certainly commands the undead? It seems like it makes a certain amount of poetic sense that the person to face him eventually should also himself have experienced death.
No, I like that point. And one thing I would add is, obviously, the showrunners added in a lot of hints about the thread of who is Jon Snow's mom in season 5. And so once that element started to play into the story, it really started to signal that, unless it's a total fake out, that at some point was going to pay off. And the other thing that sort of first sort of made me really start to doubt that he was gone was, in his death scene, they didn't stab his face, they didn't stab his neck, they didn't do anything above the shirt collar. He was kept pretty even in death. And so for that, I was just like, you know, Thrones, when they stab somebody, they have this tendency to just mess up a person in some sort of permanent visual way. And in this case, by not doing that, that was sort of one of the first big rumblings of, wait a second, you know, between that and Melisandre being back at Castle Black, even being told by everybody, because by the end of season five, you know, I was told just like everybody else, oh, he's dead. He's totally dead. I immediately started going, okay, wait a second. This is probably not what it seems.
I was sort of hoping that they would do to him what they did to Tyrion in the books. And like, you know, he would still be alive, but he'd have no nose. Just no nose for the rest of his story.
And to your point about whether death will still matter moving forward, you know, I agree. I feel like this is a card that they know is a big card to play for a major character. I feel like it's very unlikely they would play it a second time. And one pet theory I've had is that one of the reasons they were probably reluctant to do Lady Stoneheart is because in the back of their minds, they knew they were going to be doing this.
Well, when I watch the opening credits, I'm always waiting to see if there's going to be a new place featured or a place that we haven't seen in a while. When I saw Pike and the Iron Islands at the beginning of this episode, like everybody, I'm sure I squealed with joy. We once again saw Balon Greyjoy and Yara, a.k.a. Asha, got to kind of check in with them. Seems like things are not going too well for the Greyjoys, and that's before Balon walks out. And I sort of liked how the way they shot the scene between Balon and person to be named later, it looked exactly like when Han Solo walks out to meet Kylo Ren in Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Oh, that's a good reference, yes.
I'm excited too, because we sort of saw Yara at her father's funeral. You know, she naturally assumes that she'll be taking over, and she's kind of immediately told, like, well, you know, there's going to be a King Smoot. And I like how, you know, she was told, listen, maybe you'll be the first woman ever to be in charge of the Iron Islands. But, you know, this thing's called a King Smoot. So, you know, you do get a little bit of, we were talking last week about how, you know, Dany is now finding herself in this sort of, like, horrifically kind of sexist political landscape, and it seems like, you know, that's a thread they're very much picking up with the Greyjoys also.
Maybe this is a way we can extend the U.S. primary election metaphors by saying, you know, like Hillary Clinton, she assumes she should be president, but she has to go through a pesky election first.
Where should we pop to next on the map of the known world?
I think we really have to zoom over to Winterfell and talk about what happened with Ramsay, because, you know, as I point out in my recap, only Game of Thrones would stage one of the most horrific on-screen murder scenes that you've ever seen. And then at the end of the episode, you're just going, yay, Jon Snow is back, and you're ecstatic. I mean, that is quite the roller coaster of emotions to like lead people down to that dark of a place. And then at the end of the episode, have people going, dead baby? What dead baby? Jon Snow's back.
How do you feel about Ramsay at this point? Is there any element of his character that is even remotely redeemable now? Because he really stands alone. It's like him and, like, you know, Frankenstein Mountain. It's kind of stand alone as just two incredibly loathsome in every way characters. I thought it was interesting because I've been talking like a total maniac about the idea that, you know, we were heading towards a major kind of Bolton Lannister showdown, and I assumed that Roose was going to be a big part of that. Boy, was I wrong.
Yeah, and we had the first hint of a potential Jon Snow versus Ramsay showdown, a war between the bastards. And what's, you know, interesting about that is the entire time they're talking, they're assuming Jon Snow is still alive, and we're watching that scene thinking, oh, you people don't know what you're talking about. This is so sad. You know, he's actually dead and you don't even know yet. But by the end of the episode, if you go back and watch that scene, you're like, oh, actually, they're now right again, even though they were wrong when they said it. So the scene plays totally different watching it a second time after you watch the ending.
I mean, I'm going to call it out right now. I think Ramsay's dead by the end of this season. I think that, like, I really expected, like, the Bolton dynasty was going to become a key part of, like, the final phase of the Game of Thrones storyline. And I feel as if now he's on a real sort of just, this is his sort of final run that he's on now. And, you know, no disrespect to Ramsay Bolton, but if I have to choose which bastard I'm going to bet on, it's probably the one who's already been dead once. So I'm kind of anticipating, like, this is we're entering some sort of final phase for the Ramsay Bolton storyline going forward. While we're in Winterfell, I'm sure, like, anybody who's any kind of a hardcore fan for this saga, maybe even more mind-blowing than the Jon Snow resurrection, was something that we had teased a little bit in earlier episodes of this podcast. We are now seeing the past of Westeros. We are seeing into the history of these characters and these characters' parents in a way that we really haven't before.
Well, it's just so fascinating because this is a show that has always avoided doing flashbacks. The showrunners don't like to do flashbacks. Last year, they did the prophecy scene with Cersei and Maggie the Frog. And they're like, well, that's not actually a flashback because it opens the entire season. So we're not actually flashing back to anything. In this, too, there's a narrative reason for doing this because, you know, it's not just flashing back to something. It's Bran's there. You know, he's witnessing it. And we're not only seeing what happened in the past, but we're also processing it through the eyes of a current character, and what, you know, he's seeing impacts him. And this is sort of a, you know, writer geeky way of looking at it, but it's a very interesting way of incorporating the past into the show in a way that doesn't feel like you're just showing a random scene from a long time ago. It's doing it in a way that keeps the current story moving forward too.
Absolutely. And in your recap, James, you kind of compared it to the end of Godfather Part 2, which, you know, one of the reasons why that scene in Godfather 2 is powerful is it's not like anything really happens there, but our knowledge of what will happen to all these characters and, you know, what is awaiting the Corleone family in their future, it really lends it just so much sadness. And it's kind of the same way here. I mean, you know, the Cersei scene last season, that was, you know, a scene that was intended to hit you on all levels. Like, in a way, this is very much teaching you about the kind of pathology and the sort of real sadness of Cersei in a way. This scene was more just kind of like, look at this, you know, look at these characters, you know, they're having so much fun. Oh, and by the way, that's Lyanna Stark, and she's not going to end well, and that's Benjen Stark, and who knows what's going on with him, and that's Ned Stark, and boy, oh boy, he's also not going to end well. And I like how just we were aware of the fact that you know, we were seeing the Starks. Then we also met young Hodor back when he could talk. So it was just like, oh, this is just so many cute little kids who are going to have horrifying lives for the foreseeable future from here.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting thread. Hodor as young Willis. Bran asks, what happened to you? So you have to wonder, is at some point that question going to be answered? Usually in shows, if you pose a question, you eventually answer it. So hopefully at some point we'll get the answer to that.
James, cover story, Entertainment Weekly,
yes.
Kit Harington on the cover. So much to talk about here. What is your cover story all about?
The story is a behind-the-scenes chronicle of Game of Thrones' plan to kill off and then bring back Jon Snow. And a Kit Harington interview comes front and center in this because he was really at the heart of this the entire time. And it's, you know, it's not just about the show, but also what it means to be in a position where you have to tell a rather big deception about a huge part of your life, and how that deception started out as seeming like, okay, this won't be a big deal. And it just grew and grew and grew and grew. And the effect that that had on Kit and all that he had to sort of go through to pull this off. I've been obsessed with getting the story. I found this whole thing fascinating. Is Jon Snow dead became the, you know, who shot JR of the 21st century. I mean, even President Obama asked director David Nutter, hey, you didn't really kill Jon Snow, did you? It became such a pop culture obsession. And right at the heart of that was this actor who's so devoted to what he does and is so passionate about what he does. And here he had to do something which is very much in conflict with the type of person he is. I mean, the one thing he doesn't like to feel is inauthentic. And he had to, on a very personal level with a lot of people he cares about, tell them things that were untrue for a really long period of time.
Now, James, on EW.com right now, people can go there and watch a video of Kit Harington sort of speaking to fans. This video looks to me as if it was shot on the backyard of the world-famous Hibbert Estate in Austin, Texas. Where exactly did you talk to him? And, like, you know, when did this happen? And, you know, what was the kind of nature of what I can only imagine is, like, the most top-secret meeting of your career as our Westeros correspondent?
Yeah, there are lots of meetings about you know, and negotiations that went on, but you know, ultimately we actually shot that in on a ranch in California in February. So we flew out there, and the cover idea for it was that we were doing this photo session because he was being in a play in London. So that was the cover story for that photo shoot, is that, you know, we're shooting him for this play. You'll notice on the cover that he's not dressed in character. Normally, our covers, actors are usually almost always dressed as the characters they are in the film or show that they're in. You know, in this case, you know, as part of that whole deception, he was dressed in normal clothes.
Obviously, James, I am kind of two minds, where on one hand, I want to know everything about what's coming up for Jon Snow. On the other hand, you know, part of the fun of watching this show is not knowing necessarily what's happening. But to what extent does your story kind of get into what is next for our favorite bastard up north?
Pretty much every episode is pretty dramatic in terms of his storyline, so it's hard to get, you know, too forward spinning given all that's coming. But we do talk about how does death potentially change Jon Snow from a character level, and I think that's very interesting.
This was something that you know, even within the sort of like subterranean confines of Entertainment Weekly, this was something that you kept very, very secret, correct?
Yeah, literally I only told our two top editors who I needed to tell to get approval for a cover story. And one issue was, you know, we're already doing a Game of Thrones cover story before the season started. We did a cover story in The Women of Game of Thrones. Normally we never do two covers for a TV show in the same season, particularly so close together. And the other issue was, we weren't the only outlet that wanted this interview. So, you know, thankfully our editors totally saw the value in this and were hugely supportive. And thankfully, Kit, you know, agreed to trust us to tell his story.
We talked about this a little bit, but I didn't even realize what I was asking you. You must have done some like you know, Mr. Robot level, you know, methodologies to kind of like protect this information, right? Like, you know, did you have like you know, like fake laptops and you know, triple authentication codes?
Yeah, I was very conscious of trying to keep this a secret. I actually got a little bit paranoid about it. I kept everything in an encrypted folder on a flash drive that I labeled Second Coming. But also, this is kind of embarrassing. There was like a 2-month period from when I did my first on-set reporting in October to when I needed to open the encrypted folder. And I had this really horrible day where I couldn't remember the password I created for that. We've all had that experience where you can't remember a password. But of course, I didn't write it down because it was too secret to write down. So I spent a day in growing terror trying password after password. I called Apple to see if there's a way of forcing it open. They're like, no, dude, that's what encrypted means. It's designed for you not to be able to force it open. You mentioned Mr. Robot. I went online and tried to find hacking software to hack my own folder.
Give us a tease, Hibbs. How long of a story are we looking at here?
For word count geeks like myself, it's 4,500 words. It's definitely a long one. I think it's going to be spread across like 10 pages. So it's a biggie. Yeah, it's many months in the making. I love this story. I really hope readers enjoy it as well.
We're going to move on now to a part of the show that we don't have an official name for yet, so we'll just call it the mailbag, because as a reminder, everybody can email us at gotpodcast@ew.com. So let's start off here with a question from listener Gail Van Dale. She says, I'm wondering what's going on with the MIA characters. Where are Rickon, Osha, and Shaggy Dog? Are they going to return in season 6? What about the direwolves we haven't seen? Arya's wolf, Nymeria, who has the same name as one of the Sand Snakes. Coincidence? And Brandon's wolf, Summer. Also, where, oh, where is Gendry? Can I just point out here, James, this is a great question. These are a lot of characters who've been missing for a while. I can remember when they first introduced Theon's sister on the show, they had to change her name because they were worried people might confuse Asha Greyjoy with Osha the Wildling.
Or Arya Stark, for that matter.
Osha's been gone for years now, and clearly, as Gale nicely points out, there's no concern about the confusion between Wolf Nymeria and Sand Snake Nymeria. So come on, what's wrong with Osha Greyjoy? But this is a good question. I feel like we're at the point now where MIA characters are going to start reappearing. We've already seen Bran return. And, you know, again, in our sort of, like, long view of, you know, what characters are going to become important, Rickon has always struck me as somebody who might be very important whenever he reappears. And when he reappears, he's going to be 10 years older at this point. do you think we're going to see any of these characters again anytime soon, James?
I do think that the poster art for this season is telling. You know, they have the Hall of Faces and they have all these characters from Game of Thrones in there. And they have characters that are currently alive and who are characters who are dead and characters we haven't seen in a while. It does seem to be a theme this season that this idea that we're going to be seeing faces that we haven't necessarily seen in a while or that we thought we might never see again.
I'm excited about seeing Gendry again, just because that was that was an actor who I really enjoyed playing a character who was not necessarily like that important in the books and became quite important while he was around.
I feel like he's opened up a bed and breakfast with like hot pie at this point.
Well, but see, this is the problem, is that we thought that like the Brotherhood was going to be like really important. At least I certainly did, because in the books, the Brotherhood is tied into Lady Stoneheart. But now that's all disappeared. So who knows? Someday we'll see Beric Dondarrion again. Our next email comes from listener Bethany Brodigam. Not a question, but a theory. I have a theory I'm surprised no one else has mentioned yet that I wanted to share with you guys. Dany is the breaker of chains, and she's heading into forced retirement with a bunch of Khal's widows, women who are likely strong and fierce and have seen battle and possibly been raped or forced into marriage as well. She will have instant connections with these women, and they're all being imprisoned. Dany has a history of setting people free. It's kind of her thing. Do you think she might foment some insurrection in the Dosh Kaleen? Maybe the women could take over. I love this idea. I especially like the idea that we're leading to a sort of, you know, Dany being like old school Wonder Woman, leading not just an army, but an army of like totally badass, powerful women. That seems like, given what we talked about last week, James, with, you know, the fact that we've been thrown right back into the just sort of totalitarian bro culture of the Khals, I like the idea that this might be something that we're aiming towards. What are you excited about from what we saw of the preview for next week's episode?
You know, I can't wait to see resurrected Jon Snow and sort of how they handle that storyline and what that plays like. I can't wait to see Sir Alistair Thorne's reaction to Jon Snow being alive. That to me is just going to be fantastic. I will say that in terms of him being back, both Kit Harington and the producers had the conversation beforehand about, you know, if he dies and then comes back and nothing has changed about him, then ultimately the death didn't really serve a story or character purpose. So, you know, he's back, but you can definitely expect things not to be the same with John.
I'm excited for that. Now it's time for the trivia portion of our show. All kinds of exciting prizes this year. Today's question. On last night's episode, for the first time ever, we met Bran's aunt and Ned's sister, Lyanna. Hope I'm pronouncing that the right way. Bran mentioned seeing Lyanna's statue in the family crypt underneath Winterfell. In what episode of Game of Thrones did we first see that statue down in the family crypt? Listeners, please send your answer to the trivia question at gotpodcast@ew.com. If you have any more questions or concerns about this episode that we didn't get into, email us there. Also, feel free to tweet us at James Hibbard and at Darren Franich. We will try to respond on Twitter and on our next episode. And hey, listen, if you liked what you've heard here today, Please tell your friends about us. Spread the word. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a comment in iTunes. We love reading what you have to say. And we look forward to talking more about the resurrected Jon Snow, some of the exciting new Greyjoys that are coming our way, and everything else happening in the world of Westeros next week here on the EW Game of Thrones podcast.